would be fine, and then to be in Carolina in the morning.
In Carolina.
No one would be sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
Where the morning.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life in earlier times around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading excerpts from Bill Prouty's Chapel Hill by William Prouty, whose family moved to Chapel Hill in 1919. Bill Prouty was a newspaper columnist, and the contents of these articles first appeared in the Chapel Hill Weekly and the Chapel Hill newspaper. June. The first week in June was the greatest time of the year for us young'uns around the village 40 years ago. Sure, Christmas was wonderful, and so for that matter were the Thanksgiving and Easter holidays. But the finest time of all was the day they closed down the little red brick schoolhouse, now the Franklin Street Junior High School, but then the only school in town. And we ran pell-mell from the restraining confines of our homerooms, down the dusty streets, into the waiting arms of beckoning Mother Nature, and into the hair of our braced, if indulgent, parents. Off were flung the high-top shoes and the knee-length black stockings. Gone, except for church and other crowdy occasions, until school took in again in the fall. And cast aside, along with our shoes and stockings, were all our other troubles, or at least what we considered to be troubles, and we were on the town for 3 marvelous months. Beginning in June, there would be no more lessons, no more sweating our report cards, no more switchings for the smart alecks among us. And can you even imagine a paddling in a public school today? Though some of us were sure to pick up 1 or 2 spankings from our folks over the summer months. But best of all, there was to be no Johnny do this and Billy do that, Mondays through Fridays at the schoolhouse. By today's standards, Chapel Hill in the early 1920s, even when the university was in session, was a small and slow-moving village. But after the excitement of the commencement exercises had subsided and the kids had scattered to their homes, the town was really quiet, settling into a sort of 3-month siesta, until the feast of the fall, when there was a momentary flurry of activity as the influx of students more than doubled the population of the town in a few days. But if our town became in the summer a cemetery with lights, as our elders, the sophisticated teenagers, so irreverently termed it, it was to us small fry a wonderful place to be, with us and our fuss, instead of the students, the featured players on a grand, though almost empty stage. For us youngsters in those days, there were no radios, televisions, or talking pictures to divert us from our own brand of fun. Nor were there any little leagues, with their wonderful uniforms and equipment, what we wouldn't have swapped for a real baseball uniform like they have today. There were no swimming pools, or organized swimming lessons, or other supervised athletic events, or bowling or golfing facilities. But what we didn't know about, we couldn't have missed very badly, and what we lacked in organization, we more than made up for in inventiveness and enthusiasm. For movies, we had the old silent Pickwick Theater for an occasional Saturday afternoon matinee western or serial thriller, while instead of radio and television viewing, we played all kinds of parlor games, from dominoes to parcheesi, or we read, or read too, from Tom Swift, The Wizard of Oz, Robinson Crusoe, The Swiss Family Robinson, Jules Verne, Moby Dick, Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, and Boy's Life, Collier's, The Saturday Evening Post, The National Geographic, and The Holy Bible. But mainly, we just went, for long bike rides, for bare-bottomed plunges into sandy holes in Bolin and Morgan Creeks and Sparrow's Mill Pond, and for treks through Battle Park. Or we'd play all-day baseball games, with times out for meals, with a black-taped ball and tacked-together bats, hand-me-downs from the university teams, beat up, but man-sized all the way. Or we'd walk through the campus, exploring the buildings and the dormitories, or clamber to the top of Old Memorial Hall's massive dome ceiling, to peer down tremulously on the hard oak benches 1,000 miles below, Or maybe we'd shinny up the bare steel superstructure of a new building, like a steel dormitory. Or we would find an old abandoned and rusting automobile and take wonderful tours to all the fascinating places we'd heard about. Or we'd watch with awe as manacled and beautifully singing prisoners, six abreast and with picks flashing in hot, dusty sunlight, hand-graded the new paved road down the middle of Franklin Street. Sometimes we'd sit around in the backyard, eating watermelons and popping the seeds at one another, and to the always hungry chickens. Yes, there was plenty to do, and more than enough time to do it, for us Chapel Hill young'uns of the 20s. All we needed was the first week in June, and when it came, we were ready.
A sigh is just a sigh, just a sigh, just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
Growing up in Old Chapel Hill, was there ever a generation that didn't think it had more fun in its youth than any other generation? Well, just take mine, for instance. What other group was young when the airplane was still wobbly, and the mere passing overhead of one of those fugitives from World War I would cause everyone to rush outside and stare up in amazement? What other group could have discovered the radio in its infancy, sitting huddled around a little scrap of tubes, condensers, and transformers, held together by bus wire, with earphones glued to their heads, straining with intense concentration to get the weak signal? You're listening to Pioneer Station KDKA in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Or was there ever a generation, certainly none later, whose young'uns got a real thrill from a rare auto ride around the block, or big adventure out of a trip to the coast or the mountains in those good but still bulky passenger cars that knocked off at the most inopportune times, and whose tires seemed to reach out and pick up things with which to puncture themselves? What other bunch was hanging around when the galloping tintype became of age, breaking through the movie's silence barrier with Al Jolson's crackling songs, thereby dooming many a squeaky-voiced still-movie actor to obscurity? Our generation had these and many more fun things to make our lives happy, and, above all, interesting. And we young'uns who lived here were especially fortunate to be brought up in a little college town, set in a beautiful terrain with big forests to roam and little brooks to wade and fish and seine, and all this for our very front yards, with everything open to us and no off-limits to deter us. In the summertime, we would go on hikes, either as Boy Scouts or in other groups, to Hollow Rock or to Battle Park or to Bolas Mountain, carrying our knapsacks. How many of those were left over from World War I? And any other necessary equipment. Or we'd roam the university campus, or the arboretum, playing hide-and-seek and tag football or baseball. Or, if low in funds, which we always were, we would go to Battle Creek or Sparrow's Meadow or the little streams that flowed into Morgan Creek with mason jars and overturn the rocks for crayfish to sell to Dr. Froggy Wilson for money to go to the Pick Theater. Admission, 10 cents. Or, if we were in need of big cash, we would find a woebegone dog, one we didn't know, of course, and take him by to Andy Johnson at the medical school building. And Andy would give us a little note which we'd take by the alumni building and present to Mr. J.A. Warren, who'd give us $1.50 if our captive had been a male dog, or $2 if it had been a female. But somehow we didn't like these excursions very much and didn't do it very often, only as a last resort when we needed money for skates or for a tennis racket or a catcher's mitt, something like that. Mostly, we swam in the creeks, always bare-bottomed, sometimes snake-scared, and once in a while, leech-hung, our favorite holes being just above the bridge from Bowling Creek, near the ranch house, down creek a little from where Mr. Fred Sparrow used to have an old mill just east of the bottom of Hillsborough Street, where Brookside Apartments are now located, and spots both up creek and down creek from where the Pittsboro Road spans Morgan Creek. But occasionally, some of the more adventuresome of us would sneak into the little pool in Old Bynum Gymnasium, in which we were forbidden to swim. Many was the week some of us would carry dipper marks on our little behinds, because we were surprised, as we clambered out of the pool, by Poindy Poindexter, the custodian, who had strict orders to reserve the pool for students only. And on occasion, we'd think nothing of hiking out to Hogan's Lake, it was a pond then, for a day's outing. Sometimes we'd get a ride one way or the other, but likely as not, we'd walk both ways, or ride bikes. And on summer nights, we'd go frog gigging, or play tag in the big yards and in the glow of the streetlights. And during the winters, it was much the same, except for school, of course, and for reading when the weather was bad. Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, Fu Manchu, The Rover Boys, The Wizard of Oz, Boy's Life, Jack London, and Tom Swift. It was a great life for the younger generation in Chapel Hill those days, a life in which, for lack of abundance of physical things and gadgets, we had to make our own pleasure and adventure. And it was also productive, in spite of its informal and apparently haphazard way of being. It is not hard to count from among those of my generation one bishop, five or six doctors, 8 or 10 lawyers, many college professors and newspapermen. There were also, of course, some failures. And how does this compare with the later generations, which have had more and more material things to soften them up and cut down on the imagination and originality of purposes of their members? How do those generations, which have had it so easy with their radios, TVs, automobiles, boats, bikes, and mini-bikes, compare with ours as a producer of men and women of accomplishment? How have the youths of these later generations, brought up on the lap of luxury, fared in the hard and unrelenting world? As well or better, really, than those of my generation, I suspect. But I still say they didn't have as much fun.
My heart is a sad affair. There's much disillusion there. But I can dream, can I?
Chapel Hill in mud and dust time. Dusty? Why, I recollect. So you live on our town's very few unpaved streets. And in the summer months, and especially if you don't have central air conditioning, the dust settles on the furniture and on the windowsills and on the floor. And during the long dry spells, haven't had many of these lately, have we? The grass and even the trees and shrubs get a grayish coating. And if you live on an unpaved road in the city limits, you're continually after the alderman and the town manager to hurry up and get it paved in front of your house. And if you live on a dirt road outside the town limits, you're even ready to sign a petition for annexation. But you know, it seems like a little dust nowadays goes a lot farther than it used to, and causes quite a bit more concern. Take Chapel Hill back in the early 20s, for instance. At that time, our family lived in the old Barbie place, where the University Methodist Church Sanctuary now stands. Franklin Street, upon which the old house faced, was devoid of pavement. As a matter of fact, the only pavement I remember in the village at the time was the sidewalk on the north side of Franklin Street, a few dabs on the south side of Franklin Street, where the university service plants and town hall are now located, and a sidewalk on South Columbia Street in front of the University Baptist Church. During the summers, the farther back you go, the dustier they get, don't they? The autos, trucks, and wagons trailed white dust clouds behind them, which would, when the wind was right, promptly dumped themselves onto the Barbie lawn, porch, and inside the leaky old structure. Dusting. If you kept that place thoroughly dusted during the driest part of the year, you would have had time to do very little else. There's an old magnolia tree that still stands in front of the church, which back in those days used to be alive with fussing, roosting sparrows on hot summer evenings. But during the sweltering days, the tree stood empty of birds, still, or ruffled by gentle breezes, its naturally glossy leaves dulled by thick layers of adhesive, powdery dust. And the huge boxwood bushes that used to line the walk in front of the Tankersley home, which stood next to the old downtown post office building, would become so saturated with dust that you could smell them 20 paces away. Those unfortunate enough to bump against the bushes, or curious enough to jostle them, were rewarded with a deluge of stifling, choking powder. But if the dust in those days was a nightmare to the grown folks, I can't remember that we youngsters had any special distaste for it. The only harm that it did the small fry was to make them a little more susceptible to the sniffles and other minor nasal and bronchial disturbances. And just think of the fun. How many better feelings have you ever had than to walk around barefooted in nice, shade-cooled, fine-grained dust? I can remember plopping one foot after another plumb out of sight from home in the dust on Franklin Street, leaving in my wake little dust dimples, ringed by the flopping seams of overall pants legs. If the dust was bad, then the mud was worse. For the grown-ups, that is. Now it was the mop and broom instead of the oily cloth and the feather duster. And the hungry youngsters beaver-tailing barefooted through the kitchen for snacks, leaving clusters of soggy dirt in their wake. And the mud was so delightfully oozy to hot little feet. Come to think about it, I don't remember ever hearing a youngster in my time make a single complaint about the mud. In fact, the most vivid memory of mud in childhood in Chapel Hill in the early 20s is that of the fun we used to have playing and splashing around in the puddle-pocked streets. All of which is a long, long way from today's dust problems of those people living along the few remaining unpaved streets of our town. For these people, no doubt, it's been much too long a time.
Now by the old mill stream, where I first met you, with your eyes on...
Where, oh where, have those old quarantine signs gone? You don't see them much anymore. And it's much better that you don't. You know, the quarantine signs the health officer used to tack up on the front door of your house when some member of the family came down with one of the many contagious diseases which seemed to proliferate among us youngsters, and our parents as well, many years ago, before the advent of the wonder drugs. I've even forgotten the exact colors of the paper they were printed on, though it seems to me each disease had its own, and we had them all. But when we saw one of them on the front of a house, we knew one of our buddies inside was going to be cooped up for a spell, and that we'd best take off to other parts for a playmate. And when there was one tacked up on your house, and when either you, or Dad, or Mom, or brother, or sister, had come down with the measles, or chickenpox, or smallpox, or some other contagious disease, you knew that sentence had been passed on you, and for the next several days, you wouldn't be seeing anyone outside your family except your doctor. And remember that this was in the early days of commercial radio, and for those fortunate enough to own a receiver, its difficult tuning and squawking reception made it a doubtful diversion for shut-ins. And, of course, television, that godsend to convalescence, wasn't even on the scientist's wavelength as yet. But if the member of your family with the contagious disease wasn't hurtin' sick, and you didn't pick it up yourself, then things weren't so bad at that. Of course, if the quarantine came during the school term, then you didn't have to go. And I don't know about your generation, but to the youngsters of my time, well, the boys anyhow, not going to school for almost any reason was cause for celebration. And then there were other things we could do, such as games like dominoes and checkers, rook and other card games, erector sets and other mechanical toys, and reading, reading, reading. Nearly every family in those pre-radio and television days had a small library of children's books stuck in shelves around the house, and also one or two of the many youngsters' magazines of the day, such as Boy's Life. And then there were the old National Geographic magazines to be thumbed through over and again, and the favorite of them all, the Sears, Roebuck, and Montgomery Ward catalogs. But even with all these diversions, both bought and contrived, and the missed school, and other happy things, the quarantine vacation would finally begin to grate on your nerves, and you tired of seeing the same old faces every minute of the day, and they tired of seeing yours. And there were remedies, but they were sometimes risky. I remember one I cooked up that I wish I hadn't. Both of my brothers had the measles, and about the time their ailments were wearing off, I was wearing out. They were both up and around the house in nightgowns, this was before young'uns wore pajamas, and bathrobes, and they were feeling pretty good, and were giving me the hard time that those recovering from sickness naturally presume upon their peers. And things were getting a little close around the house. And so I slipped out of the house unnoticed, and forked my bicycle, and pedaled off for a little spin into the growing darkness. After all, who'd miss me? And weren't my brothers completely well? I rode west on Hooper Lane from our little house in Park Place, and spun up the senior walk through the Arboretum. When I got as near town as I dared, I turned around beside the old library, that's the present Hill Music Hall, and took off for home, hoping to sneak back into the hubbub of the household without having been missed. Might have been, too, if it hadn't been for that cedar post which was planted in the middle of the walk at the Raleigh Street entrance to the Arboretum. Somehow, in my haste, I rode too close to the post, and one of the pedals of my bike caught the post, and I went sailing over the handlebars, right into the middle of Raleigh Street, on my backside. Tore my pants and shirt, and skinned my elbows and the back of my head, and sprained an ankle, which I had to limp on to the house, because the post had torn the pedal off the bike. And that was the last quarantine I ever broke out of, and my brothers taunted me as the only guy who ever had an extended quarantine who hadn't had the disease in the first place. Because they both went to school that next Monday, while I stayed at home with my sprained ankle and skinned head and elbows, and, after Dad got through with me for breaking the quarantine, another very tender spot. I believe I'd rather have had the measles than what I ended up with that time. But even at that tender age, I suspected that you couldn't win them all.
After you've gone, there's no denying. You feel blue, you feel sad. You know you miss the dearest man you've ever had. There'll come a time, don't forget it. There'll come a time when you regret it.
Jim Blacknell, friend of my youth. If you ever knew Jim Blacknell, you'll never forget him. We youngsters down in Happy Valley, or Baby Hollow, officially known as Park Place, in the early and mid-1920s, used to make a beeline for Jim's wagon when it came bouncing over the hill from Franklin Street, down past the Lawsons and the Canettes on South Boundary Street. Jim, then in his early 70s, straight and strong, would be sitting on a plank athwart the boards of his wagon bed, a floppy straw hat on his head at a jaunty angle, and a tooth-filled grin on his handsome face. Jesse Jones, a big and happy rock mason, would be by Jim's side, sitting on a gunny sack full of straw, and usually driving the team. Often as not, one of Jim's many sons, and most often Jim Jr., the mason, would be sitting in the back of the wagon on a sack half full of sweet feed, jostling back and forth as the wagon's wheels bounced over the hole-pocked road. Jim would pull the team to a halt under a big tree, leap nimbly to the ground, and smile down at us as we crowded round to help unload the mortarboards, trowels, hammers, and sledges that are the tools of the rock mason. "How you, Mr. Snookums?" he'd say to my brother, Chip, of all us kids his favorite. And he'd let Chip crawl up into the wagon to help hand down the tools, or let him do some other favored chore. If Chip was Jim's favorite, however, he loved all the rest of us with plenty to spare. Fred and George Koch, Dick Dashiell, D.D. Carroll, Fred Prouty, and myself, sons of the first tenants of the new shingled cottages lately built by the university in Park Place. Jim and Jesse and Jim Jr., they built the rock walls, today still useful and strong, and planted the bushes and did the landscaping for that little settlement. And we boys were right in the middle of it all, with Jim watching over us and laughing with us and settling our little quarrels and teaching us the importance of honesty and the dignity of hard work. On hot summer days at dinner time, Jim would mete out sweet feed into buckets for Maud and Charlie, his plump, well-groomed horses, and then sit down in the shade with Jesse and Jim to eat. Many times, two or three of us would sit down with them and watch, fascinated, as they opened their tin dinner pails and the warm odor of cornbread, ham biscuits, and other substantial foods would float past our curious noses. Invariably, Jim would offer one or all of us a share of his lunch. Most of us were too timid to accept, no matter how hungry the work had made us. But now and then one of us, or maybe more, would take a luscious piece of cornbread or a ham biscuit, and Jim would get a big kick out of seeing us bolt it down. When we got home and weren't hungry and couldn't eat, the truth would come out, and Mother would send us scurrying happily back down the hill with apples, oranges, bananas, and other goodies for Jim and the others. They were always grateful, and, I look back on it, not at all dissatisfied with the arrangement. We learned many things from Jim, but the greatest of all was kindness. In the 30 years that have passed since we used to run down the hill to meet Jim's wagon, I've never seen a man more beautifully or usefully adjusted to living. Never have I found another man who seemed more completely or unstintingly to love his fellow man. That is, until one day last week, when I saw Jim again, sitting on the porch of the little log house off the airport road he rebuilt himself many years ago, after it had burned to the ground. Jim had come to this spot from Chatham County, near Pittsburgh, at the turn of the century. Jim is 102 years old now, and his hair is white, and his beard is long and white, and he can't see as well as he once could, and he has to walk with a cane. But Jim hasn't changed, not really. His smile is just as beautiful and spontaneous as it ever was, and his mind is as sharp as a razor. As usual, his first concern was with others, the first thing he wanted to know being how my mother and brothers were and what they were doing now. Alice, Jim's wife, was there. After Jim told her who I was, she went and sat across the door from Jim and me. Jim smiled and said, "We've been living together for 64 years, and we never had a cross word yet." Alice nodded her head in agreement. "But I always had the last word," Jim said, a grin busting out on his face. Alice laughed. "I guess he's right at that," she said. Jim's voice, as strong as it ever was, carried on speaking of the old days when we boys, and especially Mr. Snookums, used to visit with him. He talked of how old Jesse was dead and gone, and how lots of the people he used to work for, and others he had known so well, Dr. W. C. Coker, Mrs. J. H. Pratt, Mr. Coke, my father, and others, had passed away. It was difficult to get old Jim to talk about himself. "I'm 102 now, and I ain't got much more time here," he said. "But I know more folks down here than I do up there," he said, pointing skyward. "And I want to stay down here just as long as they'll let me," he said with a chuckle. Sitting on the bench in the yard in front of the house to pose for pictures, Jim waved his arms to indicate the boundaries of his property. "Come here from Chatham in 1902, been right here. But don't know how long it'll be before I got to move. Too many people closing in on me. Got to move before long. They getting too close," he said with a wink. "I got 111 grandchildren and 52 great-grandchildren. No, I have. Counted 'em like you would chickens. And when they all come back here to visit old Jim once a year, they fill up the yard and all out yonder," Jim said, waving his hands to all corners of the property. "And when they all get here and fill up the house and all the yard, I get off to myself and look at all of 'em and I say to myself, 'Ain't I something? Ain't I really something?'" Today, Jim Blacknell sits in the warm glow of the sunset of a long and hard but beautiful life. He says he's happy to stay here, but that he's not afraid to go. He says he's sure he'll have friends wherever he goes. And I'm certain he will also. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Following the broadcast, this episode is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.